Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 569th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And for those of you who, you know, listen to all of our podcasts, first, I apologize. Two, we were talking about the riveting topic of statistics.
Yes. And I'm sure people are excited to get back in that rocket ship.
Yeah, so we talked about descriptive statistics where we know if you do an election, you know, 10,000 people voted, and we know that 65% voted for this group and so on. And then we were getting into the whole concept of inferential statistics, which is where you are sampling a population, whether it be a poll or whether it be a clinical trial, and then trying to use inferential statistics to tell you really how well is the answer that you got likely to be this, the actual real true result. And it's actually tricky because we can't necessarily come up with probability. So that's where we're going to go next. We're going to now say, how do we use all of these issues associated with statistics in from a clinical trial? So that's where we're going. Any thoughts on that, Mike?
Nope. I'm looking forward to it.
Are you? Okay, good. So we use inferential statistics when we do clinical trials because we're trying to study a subset of the entire population that might potentially receive this an intervention. So what's really important is that we first start off by understanding that the sample population is really just a subset of the entire population. That's why we do inferential statistics on this. So the basic example to think about is just a drug versus placebo, and then as you, hopefully most of you know, you randomize people into two different groups, and one group is given the drug, the other one gets the placebo. And we're going to assume for this example that the whole randomization is being done properly and so on. But the main reason we do randomization is to try to make sure that we get a balance of different baseline characteristics between the two groups. And once you get to sort of 1,000 or 2,000 people in a clinical trial, they pretty much balance out in almost all cases. And I think you'd agree with that, eh, Mike?
Yeah, and I don't know if you're going to talk about it at all, James, but there was a pattern or propensity, I guess, to do statistics on baseline characteristics.
Exactly.
And probably should never have been done. But interestingly, some of the biggest trials, particularly, you know, 15, 20 years ago, were doing that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been a, I mean, there's so many things that are a source of annoyment
to me. Yeah, but that one, because what happens is if the trial is big enough, mm-hmm. and you report enough baseline characteristics, like let's say 30, mm-hmm. some of them are going to be statistically different.
Right.
But also not meaningfully different.
Yeah, and that's the that's a key thing. And you're exactly right. And Mike, it wasn't that long ago, a 2010 study reported that it was still the case of half of all reported RCTs in the New England Journal of Medicine in JAMA were reporting baseline statistics on baseline characteristics.
Yeah, so there you go.
That's, yeah.
And you shouldn't be wasting your p-value on that. We can get that. We can talk about that later. But also it's going to create – I remember some people saying to me with the ALHAT study – well, you know, they found that there were differences in, I forget which subgroups. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at it, it was a fraction of a percent difference.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that and it really shows that there's a complete misunderstanding of a lot of people of the purpose of inferential statistics, because there will always be differences in baseline characteristics.
Yeah,
and just some of them numerically.
And if you've got a big enough study, you're going to be able to show, like ALHAT was, thousands and thousands of people per group.
Yeah.
And so it was only natural that a few of them would be statistically significant, but really they were meaningless.
Yeah. And in fact, you don't have to do any sort of statistics on it. What we recommend though is you simply look at them and see if there's any differences in baseline characteristics that you think are important enough and or large enough that it may have influenced the outcome. And but you're right. I think when people look at, oh, they go, oh, look, there's a statistical difference. And then you go, well, yeah, but who cares?
Yeah, and like if there's a difference in smokers between, let's say it's a cardiovascular trial, mm-hmm. which we know smoking affects. But if the difference between the two groups is 75.3% and versus 75.1%,
yeah, who cares?
I care. But if the difference, and I've chose smoking because it mm-hmm. is something that matters. But if the difference was 30% versus 80%, that may well be driving the differences yeah. found in the groups, right?
Exactly.
And so it's they can be important, but they require, and God forbid we would say this, but they require more rational review mm-hmm. than they require statistical analysis.
No, exactly. No. And as you know as well as I do, you can actually force the randomization process to make sure that you do get equal numbers of male, female, and so on and so forth, because you could.
Yeah, and block.
Yeah, so yeah, block randomization to try and get it.
Stratifying.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, stratification. Right. And the reason you do that is because wouldn't it be a shame if you did this, you know, $100 million yeah. trial and there was for some very rare chance that there was a big enough difference in baseline characteristics that you couldn't answer the question. So that's why that's done. So realize when it comes to baseline characteristics, you have to just think of those as being descriptive statistics, nothing to do with yeah. inferential stuff, and then use your clinical judgment about whether you think those differences are important. Now, you can do some sensitivity analyses for the different characteristics, but that's, you know, I don't think we need to talk
about
that.
That's after the trial's done. You can talk about yeah. it that you're going to do it ahead, so it's yeah. set a priori, but you don't do those until afterwards. And like you said, we would stratify. Block is a different thing. You would stratify mm-hmm. based yeah. on these things so that you can control. You don't do it for all of them, but you do it for some. And James, you and I have been around long enough, and we've seen it in the big studies, to see differences like we implied, like, you know, 75 or 80%.
Yeah, so it's almost never.
That happens in a trial of 15 people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't happen in a trial of 1,000 people.
No, never. It just can't. Just it's yeah. the law of large numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the trial. So if we've got proper randomization, two groups should be pretty well balanced. And so if that is the case, and we're looking to see what goes on, there's really only three possible explanations for any observed difference. There's an undetected source of bias or confounding that could influence it. If there's something about the groups we just didn't know were different, that could be doing it. Or the result really was simply due to chance. And so it is possible if you flip a coin 1,000 times, you get 1,000 heads. It's not going to happen in anyone's lifetime.
It's possible.
It is possible. It is. So any result is possible, and then it could be a chance finding. If it wasn't chance, and if there was no bias or confounding for that reason, then the only conclusion is the intervention actually was the cause of that outcome. So that's really what we're doing with statistics. The only thing we're trying to figure out with statistics is what's the chance that what we saw could have been due to chance. That's all statistics tells us. But people make a lot more out of it than that. I think you've seen people make a lot more out of it than that.
Yeah, well, especially if it favors a belief they already have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
when we really jump on board with things and try and overinterpret them.
Yeah. So let's go just through a very simple concept of a trial. There's a new medication thought to possibly reduce the chance of a person having a heart attack. One group will get the medication, the other one will get a placebo. And I always hesitate to use the phrase null hypothesis, because that sounds, I know. Yeah. I just said it and you almost had a seizure.
I had the heart attack. No, I hate it because it, well, you're going to get into it.
No, go
it,
ahead. Though.
The way it's written, I had a used to give a talk, and it was based on that old advertisement by a financial firm that when we talk, so when people listen or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I used to say, when statisticians talk, no one understands. And it was a play on that, but like the way you have to think about the null hypothesis can sometimes be a bit tricky.
Yeah, it's kind of, it sometimes feels like a double negative.
It exactly feels like a double negative. But so please go ahead.
Yeah. Wait, so now I'm going down that. Thank you so much for sending me down that path. Okay. So, but it's important because it is part of the whole statistical hypothesis, and in this case, the hypothesis is that the new medication has no effect, mm-hmm. and so therefore, we should see very similar chances of heart attacks in both groups if that treatment has no effect. That is, as simple as I can make it out, is the null hypothesis, that there is no effect.
And if there is a difference, you're rejecting the null hypothesis.
Whoa, very nice. Yes, very nice. So now that's a triple double negative.
It is very challenging at times to interpret this, but that is what the null hypothesis takes the stance that there's no difference between these, and you're going to try and prove that that's false. Now, the irony is, of course, that no one does a study like this, a superiority design study, with the intention that there is no difference. They're certainly hoping that what they're studying is going to show a difference. So the idea that we're starting from the principle of it's not going to work is kind of false at the face.
No, exactly. But that's
it's okay. The principle of statistics that we start with.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And so we're going to be doing some inferential statistics on our findings, but it's really important to realize that these statistics do not tell us whether an intervention worked or not. I know that kind of feels a little bit, you know, odd that, you know, because something's statistically different that it must have worked, but that is not what statistics tell us. All they will tell us is they assume the observed difference was solely due to chance and then simply give us an estimate of the probability of such an occurrence over many potential repetitions of the study or the trial. That's all it tells us. So really, whether or not something worked or not is not what the trial is doing.
But that's how we interpret it. It's the easiest way.
It is. But there's so much else. And we'll talk about, you know, all the other things you have to consider. And it actually isn't necessarily a statistical thought process. We use statistics to help inform whether or not an intervention worked, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I think, hopefully that makes enough sense.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I don't. We'll see. Statistically speaking, most people have lost us, so there we go. So in our example, one group gets a new medication, the other group gets a placebo, and we count up the number of people in each group who have a heart attack over, say, 5 years. So that's, you know, basically what we do. Obviously, Mike, even if we didn't give a medication or placebo in either group, it's likely that there'll be a numerical difference between the groups in the number of heart attacks, just by chance alone.
Yeah, it's almost all the time.
Yeah.
There are rare studies where they get the exact same number.
Yeah, that always annoys me. Just I kind of go, are you kidding me?
What are the chances of that happening?
Yeah, exactly. But it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we will see a numerical difference, period. Now what we have to do is go, do we think that numerical difference was due to chance? We actually have no way of knowing or determining this. Therefore, we have a thing called a p-value as a criterion to help us reduce the subjectivity in making the decision. In other words, what we didn't want it to go is have someone like, oh, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And go, oh, it must be real.
More likely, not even it's a big difference. It's more likely, ooh, that favors what I believe to be true.
Exactly. So that's why we do statistics. And as noted, as I mentioned ahead of time, there's only three possibilities: chance, confounding due to bias, or a real effect. So inferential statistics are getting us to deal with this chance, the issue of chance, nothing else. So when we're trying to figure out what's going on when we're using statistics, I don't think we really need to worry about the complex mathematical computations that underlie the whole process. Now, there's a caveat. There are different ways of getting p-values and confidence intervals, but Mike, I very rarely do I even look at that. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I don't really. When we do our own on responder analysis, I do take into consideration you know, chi-squares versus Fisher's tests, all that kind of stuff, but not very much. And certainly when we do our meta-analysis, we do debate a lot on odds ratios, rate ratios, and then fixed versus random effects, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that's kind of it. We don't get into.
I always say if you're not doing these trials, just leave that to the statisticians. Now,
absolutely,
you will get sometimes burned because it is possible to keep. You go, well, if we did it with this test and if we did it with this test, but it's all because people are trying to get that statistically significant label.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's the problem with doing that. So I think it's really important to realize that we don't care whether, someone does, whether there was a Bonferroni procedure done on the statistics.
I
very rarely think about that other than I use that word to make it sound like I'm smart. So.
And thank goodness, because without that word, it was in question before.
No, exactly. So, let's sort of talk about that, a thing called a 95% confidence interval. And it would be much nicer if this was a visual podcast, but it isn't. But I would suggest...
Can I just ask, James,
yes.
Is that because you had... I know you were practicing your interpretive dance of statistics.
Yes, yes.
Is that why? Or were you actually going to show like graphics?
No, because I'm really very nicely dressed today.
I know. And I thought that... I thought your routine...
Yeah, it was lovely. It was, you know, yes.
Lovely.
Yeah. The tap at the end, I think, the tap dancing was just, it was thrilling. I can only say it was thrilling.
Well, it wrapped it up quite
nicely. It did. Yeah. Back to something that makes even less sense. Okay. Mike, if I said, what's a bell-shaped curve, do you think almost everyone knows what that is?
Yeah, they know they've been plotted on it at some point in their schooling.
Yeah. So 95% confidence intervals are, let's talk about what a bell-shaped curve. You know what a bell-shaped curve is. It looks like a bell. Sort of, you know, starts at one edge and goes up to a peak and then back down to the other edge. And a lot of things in medicine and life are bell-shaped curves. We have... bell-shaped curves for all sorts of different things that we can look at. And if you're looking at a bell-shaped curve, obviously the bell-shaped curve contains all of the potential results, if you will. And we can split those into different groups. We can look at the number of people who fall under one standard deviation or two standard deviations. Don't even worry about how you calculate standard deviations other than to know that plus minus one standard deviation contains about 68% of all the results. And that's, you usually describe that in the middle of the bell-shaped curve. When you get to plus minus two standard deviations, that's right around 95% of all of the results in that bell-shaped curve. That's what a 95% means, is that if you get outside that 95% or more than minus two standard deviations, then you're outside 95% of the results. So in other words, if you're outside of 95% of all the results, you only have 5% left. Did you like how I did the math on that, Mike?
Yeah, it's exceptional.
Yeah,
it's still reeling.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So if you've only got 5% left, that means you have 2.5% on one side and 2.5% on the other side of that bell-shaped curve. So that's... an important thing to understand when we're talking about 95%, not necessarily confidence intervals, but just what we're talking about when we're talking about 95%, in this case, of a sample population. Now, about 100 years ago, maybe 90 years ago, a statistician called Ronald Fisher somewhat arbitrarily proposed that exceeding a p-value of less than 0.05, which means you're finding a result that is outside that plus minus two standard deviations, is what we should be using for statistical significance. And I bet Ronald Fisher did not realize how big of a problem he was creating, right, Mike?
Well, he didn't like all of us, we need a number to go on that we can kind of all gather around.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't realize how slavish we'd be.
That's a great way to say it. I agree. Yeah, he didn't realize. And just so you know, none of this had anything to do with medicine.
No, it was just general.
Yeah, he was
general statistics. Yeah, that's all.
The article that he talked about was called he brought up the whole concept of a 95% of a p-value was called the arrangement of field experiments, Mike. So it was a way of statistically looking to go, if we put manure on an acre of ground and then we look to see how well the crop, how much it yields, there's obviously going to be a variation no matter what we do, but how mm-hmm. big of a difference would we go, yeah, you know what? We consider that statistically different. So no, he decided that 5% point is where we should be going with that.
So you're saying that the p-value
is based on manure.
Yeah. On manure.
Yes.
Which, yeah, we can.
There's so many funny lines, but you know what? We're going to be more professional than that.
We're going to dig deep for the first time.
Oh, God. That's just terrible. But it's fun, but it is quite clever though, yeah. You know, and you know, we could have you could easily draw it instead of, you know, just so you know, 5% is sort of like 1 in 20. You could draw it at 1 in 50, or mm-hmm. 1 in 100. But this was an interesting line. This is what he said. He said we could draw it at that point, but he said this is what he wrote in his paper. Personally, the writer prefers to set a low standard of significance at the 5% point and ignore entirely all results which fail to reach this level. So it was just an opinion, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But, and then, you know, others subsequently have said that because we have so many studies now, many will be positive just by chance alone at a 5% risk of
Chance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but Ron, I think he liked to be called Ronnie.
Ronnie Baby.
He did not anticipate the number of studies, and as he pointed out, mm-hmm. it was, you know, a personal opinion at the time.
Yeah,
which has become
dogma.
Nothing short of dogma.
Yes,
yeah. It's gospel now.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to say there is really no fundamental difference between a p-value of 0.06, 0.05, or 0.04.
No, there's nothing, but there's fervor.
Yeah, and you know, we wrote we'll talk about a paper that we wrote in a little bit. We've seen researchers report the p-values to so many decimal places to make sure that it is less than 0.05.
Yeah.
You know, it's a major problem. And I thought there was an interesting article published where they said, they were talking about this thing, and their line was, we want to underscore that surely God loves the 0.06 nearly as much as the 0.05.
Yeah, but it's, you know, a lot of people would dismiss the 0.06 and feel that the just marginally less than 0.05.
Yeah, exactly.
It's truth. And that is.
And if you think about it, we talked about the bell-shaped curve, and many of our physiological parameters come under a bell-shaped curve, whether it be, you know, sodium or potassium. Sometimes a bit of a skew for some of them, like maybe blood pressures and so on. But because, and I don't know if everyone knew this, but almost all of the normal lab values come from choosing the range with which plus minus, you know, 2.5% on either side are considered abnormal. But almost all lab tests, not all of them, are coming from people who are otherwise healthy. I don't know if I said that right, Mike, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're for sure. They're from healthy people.
Yeah.
And then we get a range, and then we accept the things on the outside of the range
as being unhealthy, but we weren't actually testing it to be whether they were healthy or not.
Yeah.
By definition, they were healthy.
Reporting is variance, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It's reporting variance in a normal population. Yeah.
And one of the, and a cool little number to think about is, and we've talked about this probably on previous podcasts, that we don't want you to order thousands of tests because just by chance alone, some of them are going to be abnormal. And I think the number is, if you do 15 tests, there's a 50-50 chance one of them will be abnormal. And you know the emotional response to an abnormal test, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when we said that they were normal but developed the sample, what all of us know in subtext there is that some of those normal people are not normal.
No.
In that some of them are actually sick with something. Some of them who have an abnormal test result that fall outside of the 95% range are absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And that's a normal result for them. But some of them will also have unknown or undiagnosed illnesses.
Yeah, that's right. No, but it's important to say it's unknown because they wouldn't randomly go, let's take 100 people with cancer and measure all their levels.
Yeah, and measure their hemoglobin.
Yeah, exactly.
No, they didn't do that. But out of that 1,000 of people measured, mm-hmm. some of them will have anemia. Some of them will have anemia for other, like some of them will just have iron deficiency anemia. Some will have cancer-related anemias, all sorts of things. Anemia of chronic disease. So we do capture some of that normal sample is not normal, but the majority has no underlying conditions.
Exactly. Yeah. So when we do a clinical trial, we end up with the result, whatever that, and we call that the, again, not a term that I think is great, but a point estimate. I mean, mm-hmm. why do we call it that? It's just what we found.
Yeah.
The actual number. So that's the actual difference observed. And then when we do that point estimate, we can, within the context of that, give that point estimate either a confidence interval or a p-value. And I would like to suggest, and I think most people, I hope, would agree now, is that you really don't need a p-value. It's much more informative if we use a confidence interval. And we're going to talk a little bit about a confidence interval probably in the next podcast. But I think if a confidence interval is provided, a p-value adds very little, if anything, to the interpretations of the findings. And in fact, I think a p-value creates havoc sometimes when we get to that.
Well, it's that slavish adherence to it. And
exactly.
Statisticians argue that all that a p-value, or people who do a lot of statistics anyway, mm-hmm. have argued that all you can get from a p-value that's of value is whether it's 0.05 and less or higher. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. It isn't.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not quite because, you know, if you have a p-value of 0.00001,
it's telling you something about what the confidence intervals are going to look like.
Yeah, exactly.
As well.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot more there, and I think.
Yeah.
I think that viewpoint that all whether it's less than 0.05 or higher than 0.05, that kind of slavish adherence goes back to what Fisher said. This is his. For all intents and purposes, arbitrary cutoff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so for us to put weight on it, the thing is more about understanding the reliability of those numbers and confidence intervals, regardless of
yeah.
that p-value, confidence intervals will tell us a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you don't really need to know the p-value if you know the confidence interval.
No, you don't need to. I mean, yeah. we often.
But often people put both in, and I don't. Yeah, it's just because, again, it makes us look smarter.
Mm-hmm.
So on that note, given how smart we are, we're going to end this podcast. And I think probably do one more on this, I think. And what we will do is we'll take all of this and we will take an example of a clinical trial. And that trial is going to be the HOPE trial, if you're interested. It's the trial why basically everybody in the world is on RAMPRO. And explain what the results were, and then explain how you can interpret the p-values and confidence intervals and all that sort of stuff. So just want to remind people that we have a course coming up in Vancouver on May 24th and 25th. So we would love it if you would attend. It's called Make Evidence Matter to Everybody, and HEC Talks. We have a website for that, so you can go and log into that, but see what the topic is going to be. See if you're interested in showing up. It's both live and we will be doing it via Zoom as well. So that would be great. Mike?
Yeah, so you're talking about the virtual conference. It's mm-hmm, there.
Yeah.
You can either go to Vancouver, which is lovely, or attend virtually. We have, if you enjoy the podcast and other things that we do, like Tools for Practice, etc., you can sign on to CFPC Learn or subscribe to CFPC Learn, and you get the credits entered automatically for you when you do these activities. So that is highly convenient for a practicing family doc to just have their credits entered for them.
Yeah, makes it a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure.
Great. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.